Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, as we keep discovering, there are many different ways into understanding London. Very often it's through looking at the lives and deeds of individuals. But sometimes you can't help noticing that an institution has had an enormous effect on the shape of our capital. We regularly run into royalty, sometimes encounter the church. But what about a faceless organisation, and one that has no particular moral outlook, and one that doesn't even pretend to look out for the people? It's Friday the 11th of April 2014, I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds. You ain't never seen the like before, just a stone's throw from your front door.
Listener, we are in one of the most luxurious places we've ever recorded Londonist Out Loud. Imagine Dragon's Den. It's a very industrial sort of setup, but now made for business. We're on Devonshire Square, and with me is Dr. Will Pettigrew from the University of Kent. And, well, we're going to have to dig into why we are here on Devonshire Square. Hi, Will.
Hi. Devonshire Square is one of those great sprawling city complexes that gives a new name to a very old and important London institution. It was, in the late 18th, early 19th century, one of the most important and the largest warehousing complexes for the East India Company, which, speaking of Dragon's Den, you know, makes some of those characters look like corporate midgets.
Not a phrase we have cause to use every week on the show. We're going to, therefore, this week be unpacking the East India Company and London, and we should probably locate Devonshire Square in London for those who haven't stumbled upon it, because we're set back a little bit from where I think we're close to Bishopsgate.
That's correct. So you come out of the Liverpool Street, end of Liverpool Street station, and turn left, cross over Bishopsgate, and Devonshire Square is a complex that basically runs along the side of Bishopsgate, but is set back perhaps a block.
It's a very nice looking place, very, very tidy. You get the impression that there are lots of people here who are taking a few minutes off from working within the buildings, and they're at some of the, I would say, relatively high class restaurants and cafes and bars and so forth. Security is subtle but tight. Yeah, it looks like a good place to hang out. I know they've got wonderful fairs and so forth and through the year, and we'll come to those later. But what was this place back in the day? Where are we going back to historically to start our story?
So we're going back to the period, a turbulent one for the British government, the final quarter of the 18th century. So those difficult years for the British government after the loss of the American colonies. And we typically understand this period as a period in which the City of London and the British government shifts its focus from the Atlantic and the American colonies towards Asia, and in particular the Indian subcontinent. Unlike Atlantic attempts to form corporations to manage trade and the imperial relationship between Britain and non-European areas, the Indian attempt to do the same thing, that is, form a company to manage that relationship, was very, very successful. So by the end of the 18th century, the East India Company is consolidating its hold over England's relationship with India, and indeed is consolidating its hold over India itself. So you might see this building, and it is one in very good condition, and it still has a kind of corporate shine to it as the epitome of that very successful stage in the East India Company's history. So 1770s, 1780s.
Yes, it's got that very airy feel, hasn't it? The tall windows and the small panes of glass within them. Lots of space and light. What I know about the East India Company at the moment could be sketched out on the back of a small stamp, but my impression of it, I suppose, is something akin to the Empire in Star Wars. It seems to start out with some sort of trade thing and just stretch its evil fingers into all sorts of stuff that it shouldn't, sort of having a quasi-militaristic role. And where am I getting this impression from?
You're getting that from Disney's Pirates of the Caribbean. Not as good a film as Star Wars, but I like your Star Wars analogy. East India Company is the kind of epitome of corporate success, of not just corporate success, but empire building in a kind of ambiguous, unsettlingly ambiguous combination of private and public power, of corporate initiative and also military means. And it's all of those things. This is what makes the company so fascinating. This is a company that utterly transforms the world, not just England, not just Europe, not just Asia, famously, not just India, but also East Asia, but also has important contributions to make to American history as well. But it's something we cannot categorize satisfactorily. In order to make sense of the chaos of the past, historians have to find categories to analyze it. And the East India Company is an organization so big and so important and so ambiguous that it's impossible to categorize as public or private, as imperial or as tolerant, as national, as corporate, as political, as economic. That's what makes it so interesting. So you're going to need a big stamp for me to really hammer home a summary of what it's all about. But I like the Star Wars thing. That works.
Well, we've got lots of space, literally and metaphorically here, temporally and physically. Day one, what's day one of the East India Company? Does it sort of spring up deliberately, or does it manifest itself out of other things, or how does it work?
Let me give you the prequel. Higher quality than the Star Wars prequels, I hope. The Reformation in England establishes England as a Protestant country.
For overseas listeners, we're talking 1500s there, right?
We're looking at the middle of the 16th century. We can debate when England becomes a Protestant country, but in the 16th century at some point. Nationalism comes alongside the establishment of a uniform religion for England. And so the competition between England and other European rivals within Europe intensifies and grows. With the discovery, in inverted commas, of America, with the European engagement with America, you see two things. A further intensification of this European rivalry and a new setting in which this European rivalry can take place. Now, it's the Spanish who get their hands on the tremendous monetary wealth of South and Central America first. And so the English are really just pirates in the Atlantic trying to get hold of little slices, little titbits of that wealth, intercepting those ships as they come back into the Mediterranean. Francis Drake and other characters are famous for this. On a couple of occasions, they're extremely successful, intercepting the entire fleet of bullion-laden Spanish ships coming back across the Atlantic Ocean.
This really was licensed piracy, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, countenanced and encouraged by the English monarchy, the English state. What does it have to do with India? Well, some of the bounty from those voyages is invested in a company that allows the English state to encourage a commercial relationship between England and the Ottoman Empire. It's known as the Levant Company or the Turkey Company. So that capital accumulated in Caribbean piracy is translated into a Levant company. The Levant company is a reference to what we would still call the Levant today. So that's essentially the area around Israel, Syria, the eastern Mediterranean. But actually, its most important commercial target is the Ottoman Empire itself, which, of course, occupies that area, but is also sprawling over most of the Middle East in general at this point.
When the company is named after that area, and I'm asking because I'm preempting another company that's going to be named after another geographic area, can you just pinpoint for me why it is named that? Is it going after trade there? Is the money being pumped into that area? What's the connection?
That is an area from which the company derives its name that the English state is trying to develop a commercial relationship with. So that's a long way from here, from London, especially in the 16th century, to embark on a voyage over that distance is very risky. So what you want to do is pool that risk into a company. The company at this point is really just a collective for trade that has a legal authority, has a legal protection. Often that legal protection takes the form of a monopoly. That's, in a sense, the reward for investing. You get the first dibs on the fruits of that commerce. So the naming of the company is just a description of the geographical area in which you believe the commercial gains may be made. So we've shifted from Caribbean piracy into the will and desire to trade with the most important empire of the 16th and 17th century, that is the Ottoman Empire. Within 20 years, much of the capital gain from that trading enterprise is then itself reinvested in another corporate venture established by the Levant Company, known as the East India Company. So it's stage three of an accumulation of capital that begins with piracy in the Western Atlantic. The point I'm making here is it's called the East India Company, and yes, that is a description of the geographical area in which it trades, but it's really an incarnation that has a kind of global setting and a global significance.
Is the maybe we should talk about trade more generally, and particularly tying it closely to London. What was happening here, and were we at a sort of a commercial hub in London?
Absolutely. I mean, London is today, as it was in the 16th century and earlier, essentially an entity that existed to monopolize commercial opportunity in one place. Of course, there were other trading towns around the country, Bristol, Exeter, Plymouth, but they weren't. They didn't have the same kind of privileged political and constitutional position that London has, London had and still does, let's face it. So these companies often stipulated that to be a member of the company, to trade within its infrastructure, or indeed to invest in its stock, you had to be a freeman of the City of London. In other words, if you're a Bristolian, don't even think about it. And if you're a Bristolian wanting to trade to the Ottoman Empire or to the East Indies, you're in trouble. That's a serious crime, and the state would use its resources to intercept you, sequester your property, and prosecute you. So this is all about channeling the fruits of international commerce through London. That's what these companies exist to do.
Maybe we should say something about the effect on the ground of all this trade going on from distant parts. How would people see the effects of that trade?
For the first 100 years, the on-the-ground effects of this would probably be limited to a slow realization that people were wearing different clothes. Clothes that had come from the Eastern Ottoman Empire and China that were made of silk or precious fabrics that the English were not used to wearing. And this is spoken of in the 17th century. What you see over the course of the century is a sort of slow but unsettled appreciation of the intrusion of foreign commercial styles, clothing.
And presumably that would be I'm sure it's anachronistic to call it the luxury end of the market, but it would be very wealthy people, would it?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not anachronistic. Luxury was exactly the word they would have used. They would have had a different connotation, that somehow using these fabrics, and they were expensive, was disadvantaging the domestic producer. And was expressive of a newfound interest in outward appearance and consumption for its own sake that was socially unsettling. So luxury was a word they would have used, but had a very specific association for that word.
So we've got the birth of consumerism.
Yeah, but mainly for those with a higher disposable income. I suppose the other thing that you would see in the first half of the 18th century is the increasing consumption of tea. I mean, that's what most people associate the East India Company with. That is itself a luxury for the first stage of importation, but becomes by the second of the 18th century something that many people are able to consume and enjoy.
Now, particularly anybody who is outside of the UK will almost certainly know of our reputation as tea drinkers. Whether we've still put as much of it away as we used to, I'm not quite sure. But have we ever seen tea before that period? Was anybody interested? Or?
Good question. I'm tempted to reach for my cup of coffee at this point and ruminate on that further. But I think coffee was much more familiar to people. This is an import from the Middle East, but also from India, one of the important import goods from the East India Company. And it's very important to stress that the East India Company had jurisdiction commercially over the Indian subcontinent as well as the eastern part of the Ottoman Empire, was coffee in the 17th century. And coffee is the beverage of the 17th century. Tea is the beverage of the 19th century, the later part of the 18th century. So coffee was an important import. Other than that, the conspicuous on-the-ground street level significance of the East India Company, I think, would have gone was not there for the 17th century.
How are we doing economically then? Because it sounds as though our interests were far around the globe, and it sounds like a buoyant time potentially. Were we on an economic upturn?
Absolutely. So it's a really important fact about the history of the City of London that the city and the domestic economy grows in one of its most crucial stages of expansion more in the 1660s, 1670s, 1680s than it does at any other point right up into the 19th century. And this happens against the backdrop of the rebuilding of the city. If you want to imagine the most dynamic period in London's economic expansion, it's that period when the city stands in ruins. And economists would have would connect those two processes in a very important way. That is to say, that infrastructure projects, imagine the rebuilding of the city as a giant infrastructure project, kind of high speed too. Pool together resources, capture entrepreneurialism, and give a kind of motion to an economy that's very, very important. That's part of the explanation, but the other explanation is that England is engaging with non-European trade in a much more serious and concerted way in that period because of these companies, East India Company, Levant Company, Royal African Company, Hudson's Bay Company to Canada, as is now. And these companies basically represent a collusion of the collective entrepreneurial spirit of the City of London's mercantile elite and the will displayed by the absolutist monarchy of the later Stuarts, that is Charles II and James II, to develop these economies so that they could benefit. The merchants would benefit and the monarchy would benefit. Why does the monarchy need to benefit at this point? Well, we've had the English Civil War, in which the monarchy has really been exposed as a self-seeking organization that's not good for the public interest. The monarchy has to keep reaching to Parliament to finance itself. It has to keep going to the populace to say, will you grant the money to finance the monarchy? Overseas trade provides a way of short-circuiting that, of bypassing Parliament, because if you can develop overseas trade and tax it and funnel it through your own coffers, then you don't need Parliament anymore.
And presumably the monarch was the one issuing various licences to trade and so forth. So I've got the impression in certain industries at the moment, the food industry is one that always gets mentioned, that there are sort of two or three big companies and that's about your lot. And the same might be said of perhaps oil production and things like that. So it doesn't sound on the face of it as though we've moved very far beyond what you're describing here, with the exception of sort of monopoly law.
Yeah, these are certainly big multinationals. multinationals. In a sense, they're the founding generation of big multinationals, and they are given monopoly privileges. You know, that's kind of legitimate in the 17th century. As I mentioned before, it's really the reward for hazarding and adventuring into these very risky overseas trade. No one would invest in them unless they had the right to monopolize them at the same time. I suppose the difference with these companies in the 17th century is that they are much more diversified in terms of what they export and what they import. And they're much more interesting, I think, politically and socially. They're a relationship with government and the constitution and with political thought and with economic thought is much richer and much fuller. Corporate bodies today tend to be more specialist. They tend to seek monopoly, but they're not allowed to. The relationship with government is just a straightforward one of attempts to lobby policy and success at times, but not, it doesn't have the same symbiotic relationship as the 17th and 18th century companies like the East India Company had with the formation of the English state.
Could you develop that a little more then?
Yeah, think of a few examples. Yes, they're founded, these companies, by a specific branch of the constitution. That is the monarchy. And they are founded in order to buttress the economic, political and constitutional power of the monarchy. But of course, over the course of the 17th century, the constitution is unsettled by the view that Parliament should really be in control of the decision-making apparatus of the state. So opposition from merchants who are frozen out of these companies assumes a kind of constitutional importance of itself. So over the course of the 17th century, outsiders into the companies are able to develop political ideas and economic ones in opposition to the companies that have an effect on the way in which the economic theory is conceptualized. This also has an important international connotation. The English economy for 200-400 years before the foundation of the East India Company had been built solely around the export of wool and woolen cloth. So when the East India Company is founded, the English merchants who run it are trying to find a good that they can export to Indonesia or India. You know, what are the people in Indonesia going to do with thick woolen jumpers, essentially? It's a difficult call to make commercially to export what England had been exporting for a long time. So from the beginning, they work out the only thing that we can successfully export to India is cash. That is precious metal. So the East India Company becomes this giant kind of funnel for precious metal excavated in South America into those great bullion-consuming economies of China and Asia. But 16th and 17th century economic theory says that the wealth and power of the government derives from how much precious metal you can bring into your country, right? You've got to bring in as much and you've got to sit on it, and the wealth of the country comes from storing all that gold and silver. So the East India Company basically has to reinvent economic theory by saying, actually, rather than hoarding all this precious metal, if we trade it and exchange it for other goods and commodities, our economy will grow and multiply. And this is a foundational insight of modern classical economic theory. So out of the desire to lobby, to justify the East India Company's privileges and trades, come these very important shifts in economic theory and political thought.
Yes, it sounds like a crowbar has been wedged between the two ideas have been prized apart, haven't they? The inherent value of an object and the sort of notional value of it. What are we doing for currency at this point, by the way? Are we still in a place where coins can be clipped and all that stuff? Is it still the value of the metal of the coin?
That's right, yeah. We're in a kind of a period in which the intrinsic metallic value of the coin is very important. The coins, we have the Bank of England later in the 17th century, but each note issued by the bank, it is still understood to be convertible into precious metal. That relationship changes over the course of history. But yes, we are in a period here in which currency's value is determined by the understanding and the fact of a precious metal content.
Well, I haven't yet heard any signs that the East India Company is going to do anything but succeed and go on forever. But, of course, it's not around anymore, so something is going to go wrong somewhere along the line. We're going to find out what that might be after a short word from our sponsor, with whom we have an excellent commercial relationship.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. We are at Devonshire Square. And, well, I hope we've made it clear why we're at Devonshire Square. We should underline that, probably. They're treating us very well here, I must say. And I don't know if you've had a chance to get down here yourself, but you should. There's lots going on. And I know they've got a summer fest coming up, of which they're extremely proud. We've mentioned the many food stalls. There was a roasting hog outside as I came in, and their food fair looks like it might well entertain your taste buds. I'm here with Dr. Will Pettigrew. We're talking about the East India Company and its sort of global reach from this hub of London. Let's just underscore the relevance of us being here in Devonshire Square.
Yeah, this is the sole remaining building that belonged to the East India Company. This part of London, where we are in between Liverpool Street Station and, I suppose, Tower Hamlets, was utterly dominated by the company. There were many, many warehouses here. And alongside the company's road, commercial road, that connected the company's headquarters on Leadenhall Street to its network of docks that it helped also to build. So we're right in the centre of what was a whole district of the City of London that was owned and managed by the East India Company.
Ah, some of those street names are starting to have a little more resonance in my ear now. Commercial Street, Commercial Road. Any other street names that would connect us to the East India Company and its doings?
I was walking earlier in just off Cornhill. There's Bengal Court, which is right next to where the East India Company's coffee house was, the Jerusalem Coffee House. So, yes, I mean, the association's going to penetrate further into the city. But as I said, this connection between corporate HQ and Leadenhall Street and the docks, which is basically where we're sitting now, was the East India Company's kind of manor.
It's interesting that you mentioned coffee shops, or coffee houses, rather. It's a long time since one of those has had a mention on the show, and this was very much the time when they started to get a life of their own.
That's right, yeah. Sort of halfway through the 17th century, coffee houses begin to spring up and kind of proliferate around the city and then into the West End. And we can really associate the East India Company and its escalating business with them, insofar as, yes, coffee is one of the import goods that the company brings in, but it's company management, company ships captains, company shareholders who form the kind of one of the mass of population swirling around in those coffee houses.
So ripe with the gossip and sort of possibilities for connections and trade.
Yeah, pirates swarming around off the Gujarati coast. The news of shipwrecks off Japan, all of this kind of exotic material had as its kind of focal point the East India Company's activities in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries.
We're going to move on with the story of the East India Company and perhaps touch on one or two of the personalities associated with the company and the period. But I realise we've said very little about yourself. You're a doctor of, history, I presume?
That's right, doctor of history.
What has led you to examine this particular subject?
The difficulty of categorising the East India Company as a kind of historical actor set alongside its obvious historical significance as the developer of globalized trade, as the developer of English prosperity, and the developer of various foundational aspects of the history of modern India.
I wonder whether that's a choice then of something to be working on. Is that because it just naturally excites you as an idea, and there's plenty of meat on the bone there, or are there practical consequences in terms of the life academic, where you've got to have something of this sort of sprawling sort to be able to get your teeth stuck in?
I'm not sure I'm prepared to see the distinction between the two of them at this point. I mean, having spent the day reading and scratching my head and wandering around London waiting for inspiration. It's a subject that's I think important in helping us understand why the world is the way it is today. I mean, it's impossible to understand the 21st century without appreciating the fact that most people in India speak English. No East India Company, no English being spoken in India, perhaps. So, as far as I'm concerned, academic life should be useful in explaining the way in which the present and the future might go. But it's a story brimming with adventure, exoticism, intellectual kind of fodder, but also romance, excitement, tragedy, violence, wealth, politics, corruption. Everything is there.
Crikey, let's have a bit of that. Where to start? That sounds thrilling. I think we've set the scene very thoroughly now, and we've had a sort of a considered lead into the East India Company. Let's get into some of that meat.
One of the things I've been reading about recently is the way in which pirates, who everybody loves, play a part in allowing the East India Company to justify increasing and escalating its political position in England, but also increasing its political position in the Indian subcontinent, in the Mughal Empire. Let me give you an example of that. So pirates are the kind of epitome of, well, in the 21st century, kind of toddler parties and fun. But in the 17th and 18th century, they're the epitome of deregulated trade. This is free trade gone mad. The East India Company, obviously as a monopoly company, is the kind of other end of the spectrum. And these pirates were roaming around not just in the Caribbean, but also in the Indian Ocean as well. And one of the things they really wanted to get their teeth into on multiple occasions was to intercept the Mughal emperor's fleet, convoy of ships, often containing his family and gifts, that was traveling from Surat, the Mughal emperor's port, to the Hajj in Mecca. And believe it or not, some English pirates intercepted this fleet, stole its cargo, including members of the Mughal emperor's family, and according to some accounts, abused, assaulted some of these characters. So the East India Company at that point was in the firing line from the Mughal Empire, saying, you know, these people are English, therefore you must be responsible for them. You claim to have sovereignty for English people in this area. East India Company did something very smart, which is to say, well, they might be English, but, you know, they're not part of our crew. If you give us more of a commercial privilege and improve our political position in your territory, we'll be able to help you track these people down and manage them more carefully.
So we've got a protection racket going on.
Protection racket, exactly. And that's one way to characterise the companies in their international operations. The other thing I've been reading about a bit is the company as, yes, a state-sponsored governmental organisation at home and abroad, but really, in actual fact, overseas, providing a kind of infrastructure for the creation of private fortunes, private money. Robert Clive is perhaps the most famous person, Clive of India, who was able to use the East India Company as an infrastructure to gather an immense amount of personal wealth for himself. But there are earlier and perhaps more important examples of that. Private traders within the English Indian remit were at times working with the East India Company's monopoly, but at other times were doing a bit on the side. And the most famous person here was a man called Thomas Pitt, who became known as Diamond Pitt for the rest of the 17th and early 18th century. It's a person who got hold of an enormous regent, known as the Regent Diamond, ultimately in the 18th century. This is a diamond of 410 carats. That's the sort of, what is it, cricket ball size that he was able to bring back into England, try for many, many years to sell it, eventually sold it to the French crown for hundreds of thousands of pounds, and it became the kind of crowning glory of the French crown jewels worn by Marie Antoinette and other people in the 18th century. This one transaction was able to build a political dynasty in the 18th century. Thomas Pitt's grandson became Pitt the Elder, and his great-grandson Pitt the Younger, who invented income tax and prevented us from being conquered by France. So there's an interesting kind of circularity about this story. But the point is, the East India Company is a state-sponsored governmental machine, but it provides infrastructure for private individuals to profit for themselves. I think you could say the same thing about the British Empire in general. If you did an audit on the British Empire over the course of its entire history from, you know, 1500 to 1950 and said, you know, was it profitable? I'd say that it probably wasn't profitable for the British government throughout that period because it was so expensive to manage it. But there are conspicuous and important examples of private individuals being able to use that infrastructure to create immense wealth. I mean, Cecil Rhodes, Thomas Pitt, Clive of India, William Beckford, all of these characters. The empire is something that allows entrepreneurial individuals to prosper.
But it does sound as though those individuals would have to have been quite a long way up the social ladder in order to be able to take advantage of some of the opportunities going on there. They'd have needed to be in the right place, right time, but also the right class and be able to get out and about and be mobile and make these trades, right?
I think that's partially true. I think that actually one of the interesting things about these companies are, yes, they are exclusive bodies designed to keep certain people out. But at the same time, the world of commerce is a social leveller in this period. Think of Dick Whittington, the great myth of the City of London as an institution that favours social mobility. There are plenty of examples of the City of London bringing sort of middling sort, middle-class people into London and then converting them into very, very wealthy city grandees. And the East India Company provides a similar opportunity. These are people who are not titled. These are people who may be younger sons of gentry, but not aristocracy, who are able to use these institutions to create wealth far in excess of the oldest aristocratic families in England. And there are all sorts of merchants doing that. So, yeah, we're not talking about, you know, street sweepers of the 17th century, but we're talking about an infrastructure that allows for social mobility in a very, very profound and important way that tarnishes, in a way, or adds to the shine of the prestige of aristocracy. And the other important thing to say about the institution and its influence on political life in England is that it's a very bureaucratic organisation. So its kind of techniques of management become formative for how the British state operates. It plays an important part in financing the British state. It establishes a meritocratic system for appointing people into its organisation. It has colleges and exams. It is very inspirational for the way in which the English civil service actually is set up. So, yeah, we're not talking about, as I said, very, very poor people getting a social opportunity, but we're talking about middle-class people being elevated into a new class of wealth and power.
Mm. Before the middle class proper existed, I suppose.
But perhaps.
I always associate that with the Victorian period. I imagine that kind of clerical middle class appearing around about then.
Yeah, but if you take overseas trade in general is seen as one of those public goods that enables those people who are willing to hazard their fortunes and take risks with long-distance commerce to translate their gains into social and political power. So overseas trade appears to be an opportunity for new social groups and social climbing. But that's not to say that those canny aristocrats who've always been at the top of the political pile are not able to use it for the same ends.
Well, now, I'm going to attempt a very confident link, well aware that my knowledge of history may be lacking. So with huge confidence and no preamble, I'm going to say, but there were storm clouds gathering because not very far down the line, London's trade, particularly its far-reaching international trade and money-making schemes and so forth, were going to bring the country to its knees.
The South Sea Company is something that's perplexed people. It is definitely modelled on the East India Company insofar as the architect of the South Sea scheme, Robert Harley, noticed how, over the course of the 17th century, the East India Company's relationship with the state had been made more intimate. And basically, the state had continued to endorse its commercial privileges in exchange for initially straightforward bribes, but by the end of the century, vast loans. To the extent that the British state was, you know, partially financed by the proceeds of trade with India. They'd also noticed how a trade in stock in these companies, the kind of stock exchange element of all of this, created an economic opportunity that the government wished to benefit from. That is, escalating stock prices. South Sea Company was designed to do the same thing, arguably, with reference to South American trade. But the jury's still out on whether or not the architects of the scheme actually understood it to have a viable commercial future, or whether or not it was a giant kind of manipulation of a particularly buoyant European stock market. After the bursting of that bubble, the East India Company is very successfully able to detach itself from the poor reputation of joint stock companies.
How was it able to do that?
Well, it was able to point to the viability of its trade and the very real economic opportunities it provided. It wasn't a kind of chimera in that sense. It was a long-established and profitable trade whose relationship with the government was secure, who produced wealth on an impressive scale, albeit for a selective group of people. So as long as these companies were understood to have some kind of substance to them, and as long as that substance was understood to be good for the government, rather than, you know, dissolving of its financial prospects, as the South Sea Company was, then they could continue. Although it has to be said, joint stock companies are not often formed for trade after the 1720s, and the East India Company really goes it alone for the rest of the 18th and 19th century. It's kind of unique from that point onwards.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so that sort of ties in then with what you were saying about the divorce of objects from their intrinsic worth. And it sounds like the South Sea bubble was that going far too far and everyone getting their fingers burnt and then having to pull it all back a bit.
I think that's well put. And one of the criticisms people had with joint stock companies from the second half of the 17th century and through the 18th century is that they understood, or they characterized them as being soulless or invisible organizations. You hear this said about corporations today. Yeah, what is a corporation? It's a kind of separate legal personality. What does it consist of? Well, it consists of a bunch of people, but it also has this kind of animate quality, this invisible quality, that is its stock, that seems to have a kind of political meaning and power in and of itself. It's like a sort of sorcerer's apprentice. You know, what once you form that body, what is it able to do? And the answer to that question is all sorts of things. It's a massive amount of liquidity that can be used to finance the government, finance 200,000 troops in India, finance incredible global commercial and political reach. So our contemporary suspicion of what corporations do is partly founded on a 17th century reaction to a lack of soul or a lack of visibility. That is something that exists only in law, and you can't look it in the eye. Although we're looking it in the eye now, it's the only bit that's left. Right? This is the good thing about what we're doing now, is it's bricks and mortar of the company that we can see.
You've brought us very nicely back to London, and I sort of want to make sure that our feet are on London soil for a little bit and get a sense of, rather than us being out there doing business, what about what was going on here, and how was the East India Company seen by Londoners?
Well, I think by the 18th century, its participation in London life was even more conspicuous. In the 17th century, it occupied quite a modest sort of timber-framed corporate headquarters on Leadenhall Street. By the period just after the South Sea Bubble, in fact, that building had been replaced by a rather impressive stone classical edifice, and it was beginning to buy up land around that with warehouses like the one we're sitting in now. It was beginning to develop a good reputation for kind of corporate philanthropy. Its goods were reaching a more mass market, so things like tea and coffee and textiles were flowing into the English economy in a much more conspicuous way. It was providing an infrastructure for more and more people's employment, not just in London but also overseas. So it would really be regarded, along with the Bank of England, as one of those great institutions of city life, with tremendous wealth and eminence. Like I said, that would have translated into relationships with city churches and some philanthropic activity. So, like the Corporation of London itself, it would have become one of those great institutions of the city.
You say would have, and I know that there's a little detail here that we could reserve for later on, but with broad brushstrokes, we'll say that the East India Company no longer exists. Why not?
This has everything to do with, I suppose, shifts in economic theory that the company, as I explained earlier, was partly responsible for. That from the 18th to the 19th century, the argument that economies and economics should be entirely separate from government and politics was gaining traction. This is what leads to a series of tragedies in the 19th century, including the Irish potato famine, that you can't intervene in international trade, even if it looks like, you know, people are going to be starving to death. Companies like the East India Company, that had been around by the middle of the 19th century for 250 years, looked like, as Adam Smith described them, kind of totems of class and economic privilege that were not contributing to an efficiently functioning economy. And what you wanted to do is open access to these trades to everybody, and that with deregulation of trade came economic growth, that kind of classic liberal equation that we're all familiar with now. That's part of the story. So there's a kind of broader shift away from companies that had really been there from the 17th century onwards. What makes the Indian Company much more exposed to that criticism by the middle of the 19th century is the Indian Mutiny itself. That is the huge population that the company is ruling over by the middle of the 19th century, unsurprisingly, is not happy to be ruled in quite that way.
You do use the word ruled.
Absolutely. And so there's a violent beginning of the Indian independence movement, really, in the middle of the 19th century. And the first thing the British government does is to say, well, that mounting criticism that comes from economic theory against corporate management of this trade is actually onto something and provides the means of deregulating the trade. Instead of opening up free trade to everybody, which I suppose is part and parcel of the impact, what they're really trying to do is to get the British government to run India directly. So rather than have a company do it, which is a kind of public-private partnership, the government is going to do it directly. So in a sense, it leads to an escalation of imperial power there. But it also leads to a deregulation of the economic relationship between India and Britain, because the company as a monopoly is no longer functioning.
So it's removing the ambiguity, for better or worse, it's removing the ambiguities of certain global relationships. And what was the death knell, if one's sounding, when do we hear that ringing out for the East India Company?
Well, it's difficult to be precise about that, because this process happens in stages. But it's very important to say that the Indian population who seek to rid their country of an English presence, in a sense, or at least English government, are really the authors of the East India Company's downfall in 1857. With what we call the Indian Mutiny, in a very imperialistic way, but it's actually, you know, the first war of Indian independence.
And how did they take out their wrath and make their feelings clear in that year?
Well, there's a series of military assaults on the company's military installations within India, all over India, but especially in a place called Meerut, which is in North India. And this leads, you know, with a gap of several months, to the British government's legislative response, is to say a company is no longer fit to manage an entity the size of the Indian subcontinent. I mean, it's not running the whole thing at this point, but nonetheless, it's ruling over many more people than the British government do in Britain.
And does that mean that sort of senior people within the company were paid off and went and retired, or were they moved sideways or joined the government, or what happened to them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure to what extent the leadership of the company is blamed for this development within India, the mutiny as it's known. The company, of course, is its stock, Parliament's not in the business of confiscating people's property, their stock. And many, many families had held on to this stock for a long time. So the taxpayer has to compensate the owners of this stock later on in the 19th century. The figures I don't have, but presumably that's a large amount of money. And what the reputational, the standing of those people who'd been not involved in the company at this late stage is something I couldn't comment on.
The structure of what you've described there sounds a little bit like the bailing out of the banks of a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. Although the East India Company is dissolved by this process, it's not kept alive, it's killed off.
I'm thinking in terms of the sort of the compensation, essentially the government, aka the taxpayer, coughing up.
Yeah, the taxpayer coughing up, but that's to dissolve a company rather than to keep, let's say, RBS afloat. This is an important point about the East India Company and the history of companies in general. The companies in the 17th century, and certainly by the early 18th century, are in the business of bailing out the taxpayer. They're the ones who've got the money to keep the British government going. That's why the South Sea Company is formed, because it's hoped that it can do the same thing. But of course, by the 21st century, the taxpayer is there to bail out the company. And that's an important structural change in the history of these corporations.
Well, what a reversal, yeah. We can't possibly finish up without touching on the fact that the East India Company kind of does exist.
It does. I mean, I've been told about this a number of times. And then I walked down Long Acre in Covent Garden, and you can see an outlet of the East India Company there. I didn't have time to go in there, but it seems to be sort of expensive soap, shampoo. There's no gunpowder or silk or precious metal being traded. I suppose there was some semi-precious metal being traded, although not many things could you afford with coins in there. It seemed to be quite a luxury boutique. But I can give you the full history of the organisation. And I'm not sure, you know, to what extent the title East India Company had a kind of, you know, copyright attached to it. I guess copyrights were there by the 1870s, perhaps. But whether or not the British government was consulted about the reformation of the company, I just don't know. Maybe they needed the money. Well, we know they need the money.
So we've got a possible through line, or maybe just have a delicious echo. I don't know. We should finish up because we're coming close to the end of our time. And I sort of wanted to use the final moments to see whether there's a single nugget of information, an idea, something juicy that didn't find its way into the natural thread of what we've been talking about, something that might surprise us, and perhaps with a London angle or something further afield about the East India Company.
The East India Company was responsible not just for kind of reinventing the city of London, but also really played a part in founding some of the world's greatest cities. Bombay, Madras, Calcutta. And what's interesting about those foundations is that they were built on toleration, that the way to build population and the concentration of population in cities was to extend religious freedom, political freedom, to as many people as you could in a way that was completely impossible in London at the same time. So this is East India Company not just as empire, but East India Company as an organization using the cutting edge political insights of tolerance to build concentrations of population that are now twice the size of London.
Well, Dr. Will Pettigrew, thanks for an amazing, engrossing journey through the history of the East India Company. And looking around these walls, it's suddenly reverberating with history. What a glorious warehouse, by the way. They don't make them like this anymore. If people want to get in touch with you and see what you're up to and tell you what they've discovered, how can they go about doing that?
My University of Kent email, w.pettigrew@kent.ac.uk. Be delighted to hear from anyone who wants to get in touch.
Fantastic. And of course, if you want to take advantage of food and Summerfest and so forth down here at Devonshire Square, it's devonshiresq.co.uk. But for today, from here, from Dr. Will Pettigrew, thanks very much for listening.
My heart aches for some far off place, no one could have left you with your name.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Dr. Will Pettigrew. Thanks to Francesco Soma and Tina Baxter. Thanks to Mark Barr and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
throw from your front door.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.